Well, thank you for tuning in to the Deep Blues Hour. My name is Steve. I've been your host for classic and traditional blues the last 60 minutes or so. So thanks for tuning in. Stick around to WRCT Pittsburgh for more great music throughout each and every day here on 88.3 FM on your radio dial and WRCT.org on the internet. All right. Thanks again. We'll see you next time here on the Deep Blues Hour.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Mary.
From High
Places.
And you're listening to WRCT
88.3 FM. A radio.
I want to start today sort of by talking a little bit about 2022 and the midterms. We've been saying we don't yet really know how strong the challenges will be against these various Trumpian members of Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, Madison Cawthorn, and then, you know, folks like Matt Gaetz and many others. There's no shortage of folks who need to be seriously challenged and hopefully removed. There is a very interesting new ad from Madison Cawthorn's opponent. Basically framing Madison Cawthorn as the type of person that would end up being radicalized into a domestic terrorist, almost kind of framing Madison Cawthorn, does the ad, as like a Timothy McVeigh type. And, you know, we've talked about Madison Cawthorn before. He's a guy who, remember, he had this controversy where he vacationed at like Hitler's vacation home, or like did tourism at Hitler's vacation home, and seemed sort of like relish being in where there was what he called supreme evil. But there was something like a little bit fanboyish about it. It was all really weird. He's sort of alluded to bringing guns on the House floor. He got caught trying to bring a gun on his carry-on luggage onto a plane, says he didn't know it was there, then brought a knife to a school board meeting last week in North Carolina. You know, just a guy who's really a problematic radical, who has made it clear he's not about policy at all. He's just about memes and PR and communication and tweeting and this type of thing. Check out this ad we're going to look at. So there's a great article about this race on LGBTQ Nation, which says Madison Cawthorn has become one of the loudest and most extreme voices in the modern Republican Party. Now his Democratic opponent, a lesbian minister, is pointing out what has happened in front of voters' eyes. The congressman, like many young men, has been radicalized by extremists and fits the stereotype now for a would-be domestic terrorist. Jasmine Beach Ferrara tweeted with a copy of the ad, quote, like too many young people before him, from around the world to right next door, Madison Cawthorn exhibits the signs of a young man who has been radicalized by extremists and is now dangerously radicalizing others. In the short spot, Beach Ferrara notes that Cawthorn started out claiming he was interested in unity and bipartisanship before switching to violent rhetoric and urging insurrection. Let's take a look at the ad, because this is a very interesting approach to maybe one way to deal with some of these Trumpian extremists that fundamentally are very anti-American in terms of the values they bring forward, but they're framed as being very patriotic. Let's take a look.
Like too many young people before him, from around the world to right next door, Madison Cawthorn exhibits the signs of a young man who has been radicalized by extremists and is now dangerously radicalizing others. In 6 months, Madison Cawthorn went from this.
We're someone who can really help ease this partisan divide that's going on in our country right now.
To stoking insurrection.
Wow, this crowd has some fight in it.
And now, 8 months later, he calls these violent insurrectionists
political hostages
and can't let go of the big lie.
Because, you know, if our election systems continue to be rigged and continue to be stolen, then it's going to lead to one place and it's bloodshed.
Republican Congressman Madison Cawthorn warning of, quote, bloodshed.
Again, justifying potential violence.
I'm Jasmine Beach Ferrara. As a mom, an ordained minister, and a county commissioner, I'm running to defeat Madison Cawthorn, not by confronting hate with more hate, but with love of neighbor, love of community, and love of country. because violent extremism has no place in Western North Carolina. This isn't who we are. And we need to be crystal clear about the difference between right and wrong. Madison Cawthorn is a danger to our democracy. I'm asking for your help, not just to defeat him, but to come together to create the America our kids deserve.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, unfortunately, because this authoritarian slide has happened over time, and this departure from norms and the way we used to talk about political issues, it coarsened slowly, as we've talked about. When Donald Trump won in November of 2016, we had a bad feeling about what was going to happen. But if I had told you that day what 2020 would look like under Donald Trump, all of the insanity and all of the people that would be elected in 2018 and 2020 in that Trumpian vein, it wouldn't have seemed believable to most people. But it happened slowly over time. And then now, all of a sudden, what really are radical extremists? And if their religion was a different one, we would be calling these people probably terrorists. There would be, the right would certainly be calling them terrorists. There's no doubt about it. But because they're ostensibly Christian, and because they're Republicans, and because they subscribe or appeal to this very myopic sense of what it means to be for America, they've gotten a pass thanks to the slow slide towards radicalization that has taken place. But what this ad does a really good job of is showing, put it all together, you know, tourism in the House of the Fuhrer, these outrageous videos that have like a Columbine shooter vibe of him punching and punching and punching a tree as some kind of training that he's doing, and shooting guns and talking about there might be bloodshed if we don't fix our election system. Of course, placating the same believers of the big lie that actually did the rioting on January 6th. When you put it together, this is a very astute political ad, because it's not making the allegations wildly or in an ad hominem sense or without context. It's just showing, look at this. And if we took that video and those statements by Madison Cawthorn and you change them and it was equivalent, but a Muslim, or even just a Democrat making similar types of claims, which I mean, I can't imagine would ever happen. They would be saying, shouldn't the FBI be investigating this guy? And of course, we've said many times, actually, yeah, the FBI should be investigating this guy. So a really, really interesting ad by Jasmine Beach Ferrara. It's great to see that there are people challenging these wild, outrageous people. How well they'll do in 2022, we just don't know yet. It's too early to say. But what we can say for sure is, if we are really going to like beat back Trumpism and maybe even prevent Trump from running in 2024, it's going to depend on removing some of these people from elected office in November of 2022. Jasmine Beach Ferrara, one possibility in Madison Cawthorn's district. We'll have more time to cover her race and many of these other ones as we go forward. This is a very strange headline. Donald Trump has filed a lawsuit against his own niece, as well as the New York Times. Now, let me translate. I'm going to tell you the story, but let me translate it for you. Reporters investigated things that were newsworthy, and Donald Trump really doesn't like it, and he's suing. Okay, here's the article from CNBC. Former President Donald Trump filed a $100 million lawsuit Tuesday against his niece, Mary Trump, and the New York Times, claiming they conspired to obtain his tax returns for the paper's Pulitzer Prize winning story, Pulitzer winning story on his undisclosed finances. The lawsuit asserts that Mary Trump and three New York Times reporters, Suzanne Craig, David Barstow, and Russell Bettner, were engaged in what the suit calls an insidious plot and an extensive crusade to obtain Trump's taxes. Now, notice none of these, so far, none of that signals a crime, right? What they mean is there was a newsworthy story around Trump's taxes and Trump hiding his taxes. And there was an awareness of that among investigative reporters who tried to obtain them. Now, then it gets to allegations that, at least in theory, could be criminal. The defendants engaged in an insidious plot to obtain confidential and highly sensitive records, which they exploited for their own benefit and utilized as a means of falsely legitimizing their publicized works. It's still very weak. Like, what are the damages and what is the wrongdoing here? Craig Barstow and Boot Wetner received the Pulitzer Prize in 2019 for explanatory reporting for their series of stories, which provided the public with an unprecedented look at the former president's finances. Mary Trump has said she released Trump's tax returns to the New York Times in her best-selling 2020 book about her uncle, Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, and in media interviews, which the lawsuit notes. In the book, the daughter of Trump's brother, Fred Jr., paints an authoritative portrait of Donald J. Trump and the toxic family that made him. Reacting to this in a statement, Mary Trump called her uncle desperate, quote, I think he's a loser and he is going to throw anything against the wall he can. It's desperation. The walls are closing in and he is throwing anything against the wall that he thinks will stick. As is always the case with Donald, he'll try and change the subject. The New York Times said in a statement it plans to challenge the lawsuit. Statement from a spokesperson for the paper, Danielle Rhodes, says, quote, the Times coverage of Donald Trump's taxes helped inform citizens through meticulous reporting on a subject of overriding public interest. This lawsuit is an attempt to silence independent news organizations, and we plan to vigorously defend against it. Lawsuit filed in New York State Court. It alleges that the reporter relentlessly sought out his niece and convinced her to smuggle the records out of her attorney's office and turn them over to the Times. So what is this really about? This is about Trump's furious. Reporters investigated and reported on something that was newsworthy, and Trump wants to punish them. Now, of course, at any time, Donald Trump could publish his taxes and prove the story wrong if the conclusions of these stories about his taxes are out of context or they're not complete, right? If Trump believes what was released of my taxes is incomplete and it paints an incorrect picture, release the full taxes and then we'll actually get the full picture. He could do that at any time to prove the story wrong. But this is all distract, distract, distract. And I don't think it's also crazy to consider whether the real news of the last 5 days is, number one, that when Trump and his team were pushing the big lie about the 2020 election, they knew that it was a lie. That we've learned more so over the last week. The document with the 6-point plan outlining how Donald Trump wanted to use Mike Pence to steal the election, that came to light over the last 5 days. And so to some degree, this entire lawsuit may just be an attempt to distract from that. But I believe it will go absolutely nowhere, nowhere. I'm not a betting man, but I would be willing to bet that this goes absolutely nowhere. And maybe someday we will get Trump's taxes. Although at this point, do we even still care? I know there are some in my audience who do, others who say, who even cares at this point? But remember, he might be back in 2024. And so all else being equal, I do think it would be a great thing to finally get a hold of those taxes. Let me know your thoughts if you disagree. You can find me on Twitter at Deep Hackman. We have a fantastic program for you today, and it continues right after this short break. Remember that our program is mostly funded by viewers and listeners who get memberships at joinpacman.com. We do an extra show every day, weekdays, guys, come on, not 7 days a week. That'd be crazy. Weekdays, we do an extra show for our members called The Bonus Show. It is award winning, although we create and give the awards, so it may not be worth that much. We also offer commercial free audio and video streams of the show every day to our members. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. Let's talk to people in the audience. The audience matters, and we take calls via the David Pakman Show Discord, which you can find at davidpakman.com/discord. We're going to start today with David from St. Petersburg. Now, is that St. Petersburg, Florida, or St. Petersburg, Russia?
Hi, David. Yes, it's St. Petersburg, Florida.
Love it.
Thank you for allowing me to call. I've been listening to the show for about 2 years, and I really enjoy hearing your perspective on a lot of issues.
That's great, David. And please silence those Discord notifications. They're already going off.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes. So my question is, I'm pretty moderate, I would say. However, I'm having a little bit of an issue with what I'm seeing sort of out of the left right now. And what I mean by that is I almost see free markets being almost a swear word when I'm having lots of discussions with my friends, and they're talking about how it's a failed system and we have to move past it. And they often use Nordic countries as an example. However, I know Nordic countries to be very free markets that mainly use free markets to generate revenue in order to pay for their social programs, which is great and it works wonderful for them. However, I always hear people talking about a need to move past this system, but I haven't seen any system that works for everybody and creates the society that they want to create that is equitable and have people be happy and taken care of without a robust free market in order to have taxes that are then taken out of them to provide services for people.
Well, this is just fundamentally a question of what is one's political and economic philosophy. One thing is we've got to first be accurate. When they say we got to move past the free market and be like Norway, Denmark, Sweden, these countries have markets for the vast majority of goods and services. But what they've done is they've said there should be some areas where there is either extremely disproportionate power for things that are necessary in the market, like, you know, healthcare, education, et cetera, where we're going to take things out of the free market. So the first thing is to say we've got to get away from free markets and be like Norway. It doesn't make any sense. A lot of those countries have very good business environments with a lot of freedom. So we have to start with the facts, first of all. Secondly, I am thinking some of the people that you're talking about might be actual socialists or even communists. Is that right? Because for the most part, if you're just a social democrat like I am, you're not saying eliminate free markets. You're just saying there are some areas that should be removed from the market. But it's fine for markets to direct resources on mobile phones, you know, DVD players, whatever the case may be. It's just that there's certain areas where we need more government involvement.
Yes, I agree with what you're saying. The main issues I have is they don't categorize themselves as socialists or communists, or they just say they're liberal Democrats, and they look at policies. I believe that they don't look at the sort of the funding necessary for some of these policies as well. You know, for example, when we look at the Nordic countries, they have these ideas that the rich and the wealthy can fund everything, and it's just impossible with everything they say that is available, you know, such as the healthcare. And
well, to a great degree, the disproportionate amount of funding for those things actually can easily come from the very, very rich. But it's sounding like the people you're talking to are sort of all over the place and they may not really know what they're talking about, because a lot of these arguments kind of conflict. And, you know, I wouldn't judge these movements by the people you're specifically talking to, maybe would be my advice.
I really try not to. It just seems that maybe it's just spending too much time online and just talking to, you know, people that are more of the millennial age. I mean, you're a very, very educated person, and most people that are educated, such as yourself and in the political spectrum, you know, clearly have moved past that idea. However, I just see a very large portion of the voting bloc not necessarily being so well informed as you are, because, you know, obviously I bring these points up to you and you're just rightfully saying, oh, well, that's silly. You know, that's not actually how it works and that's not how it is.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it sounds like you're saying a lot of people are engaging in politics and not having any idea what's going on. And I would agree. There's a lot of that on the left and right. But that's more of a systemic education issue, I would say.
Yes. I agree. It's just I see what you're saying. It's just it seems that I'm just seeing it more and more from, you know, 15 years ago. And I just get worried when elections happen that I'm not saying this is really going to happen. I know it, but, you know, maybe 20 years from now, just people voting for policies that could end up being more aimed towards Venezuela rather than a Nordic country that has a very happy, successful population.
We're very far from that. There's nobody even proposing Venezuela type policy right now in any serious way. So we'll watch that. All right, David from St. Petersburg, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate the commentary from you. Let's go next to Sam from Minnesota. Sam from Minnesota, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. How's my volume?
Your volume's beautiful.
Okay. Do you really think Beto O'Rourke is a good gubernatorial candidate for Democrats in Texas? You know, he had a statewide race in 2018 and lost to Ted Cruz, of all people. And that was before he told Texans, hell yeah, I'm coming for your guns. So I don't really have another candidate in mind, but yeah. With so many people in Texas, do you really think Beto's the best Texas Democrats have to offer?
I don't know. We talked about this a little bit earlier in the week when on the bonus show, the topic of Beto running. I think what Beto has going for him are a couple different things. Number one, name recognition to some degree. Now, name recognition can be bad, as you point out, if he's known to Texas Republicans as the guy who wants to take your guns. So name recognition can be a double-edged sword. I think Beto also has going for him that he can definitely rebut Greg Abbott's failed policy very well and directly and eloquently and articulately. But I don't know if he's the best person to run against Abbott. But I'm with you in that I can't really think of anybody else. So I'm excited about the idea that because Abbott's approval is in the toilet, maybe someone with name recognition like Beto could actually sweep in and do a good job. Obviously, as I mentioned earlier in the week, they're going to run against him on, hey, these Democrats want to take your guns. Forget about the COVID disaster. Forget about the electricity disaster. Beto's going to take your guns. I think that could be a problem, but I don't have any better ideas right now.
That's fair. The other day you were talking about how you felt the interviews with families of anti-vax people who died of COVID felt really exploitative.
Sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've thought of a term for that kind of thing, and I want to know what you think of it.
Yeah.
Vaxploitation.
Vaxploitation. Yeah. I mean, the thing about it is that could mean exploiting people who did get it or who didn't. I mean, it's not super precise, but it's not a bad idea. I kind of like it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a play on the old blaxploitation films.
What about anti-vaxploitation?
Maybe.
Okay.
It's getting a little long at that.
It's a little
point,
too long. Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah. No, I mean, do you agree that sometimes those interviews feel a little exploitative and like disaster porny?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the nature of, you know, these new shows that are looking for content.
Yeah, fair. All right, I appreciate the call.
Oh, sure. I was about to ask you if you think we'll be back to normal by mid-22. But
I think we'll be back to normal by mid-32.
Okay.
No, I have no idea. I don't know. I hope so, but who knows? I think COVID's going to be around a couple years at least.
Sure, thanks.
Yeah. All right, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. Let's speak to some other people because there's really a lot of people here who want to get on. Let's go next to Alicia from Cancun, Mexico. You're on the air. Hello. Alicia from Cancun. You're on. If you unmute, we'll be able to hear you. And last opportunity for Alicia/Alicia from Cancun. You must unmute to speak to me. Otherwise, the tubes won't work. All right. That's too bad. Let's stay in Cancun and go to Eric from Cancun instead. Eric, are you on the air? Eric from Cancun, you're on. Wow. Something must be going on with the internet there in Cancun. Let's go next to, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly. Is it Ishan from Amherst?
Yeah, that's correct. Hey, David, how's it going?
It's going well. Thank you.
Thanks for picking up my phone call. So my question to you is, on Sunday, the parliamentarian Elizabeth McDonough ruled that the Democrats can't include all the immigration provisions in the reconciliation bill. Now, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin, they're all being like, oh, we have plan B. We're going to go back to her with another proposal. My question to you is, why are they begging an unelected official? Why can't they simply overrule her or ignore her? I know that in 2001, Republicans did the same thing. They probably fired the parliamentarian when millions of lives are at stake. Do you know, like, why are they just like not playing hardball and like just like ignoring her altogether?
Ishan, just, like, I agree with you completely. This notion that now is sort of like just assumed to be true, that the parliamentarian just gets to decide. I challenge that, and I've read a couple of good pieces arguing that you don't it's sort of like by tradition that the parliamentarian is given the ability to weigh in on these things, and that times have sort of changed, and that, quite frankly, I mean, this term has a negative connotation, but they could just steamroll the parliamentarian if they wanted and then deal with it later. Let Republicans say I'm against it because it's out of order, right, or whatever. But I completely agree with you, and I think it's ridiculous the way they're handling the parliamentarian.
But do you think there's any chance with Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema in the Senate that they're going to even, like, think about bringing the bill with the provisions on the floor and let Kamala Harris just ignore her ruling?
I think it depends on the bill, to be perfectly honest. I'm not sure. I think it depends. I think there maybe, yes, I'd have to think a little more about that.
Hey, thank you so much, David. Thank you so much for taking my phone call. I don't know if you remember, but like I called last year too and we talked, but yeah, probably not. But thank you so much.
Remind me, Ishan, are you in Amherst, Massachusetts or Amherst, New York?
Amherst, Massachusetts. I go to UMass.
Oh, you do? Yeah. Oh, my God. I just heard 350 positive cases last week at UMass.
Yeah, there was like a party in an off-campus gathering, townhouses.
Yeah.
Honestly speaking, if I'm going to level with you, I've stopped caring because I feel like there's nothing I can do. People are going to party left and right.
Yeah.
I can't help it. So, like, there's no point, like, thinking about it, just like it just is not conducive to my own well-being. I cannot focus on other stuff.
I totally sympathize with that. Yeah. Which townhouses was the party at?
The townhouses, which is like in Sunderland.
Oh, those townhouses. Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
They were like a mass congregation, and I feel like there's nothing I can do that's gonna change to drive the numbers one way or the other.
Yeah.
So what's the point of stressing out about it? I'm fully vaccinated. I take care of myself. I'm just moving on. I just like live my own life. Whatever happens, happens. I can't do anything at this point.
I understand, Ishan. It sounds like you're doing all the right things anyway. So,
yeah. Good. Thank you so much, David.
All right. Pleasure. There's Ishan from UMass, my undergraduate alma mater. Wow. What a call. Why don't we go next to let's go to Wynn from Indiana. Wynn, you're on the air. Is Wynn short for something?
Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Wynn is not short for anything. I'm actually originally from Thailand, but I moved to Indiana a couple of months ago.
How is that?
It's different. I'm just here for college, but yeah, it's just different.
All right, yeah. Fair.
So I have a question in regards to demand versus supply economics.
Sure.
So I was talking to my uncle who's from Las Vegas. And he sort of agreed with the idea of demand economics and that, you know, demand drives businesses and whatnot. But he used the example of Las Vegas, saying that before, Vegas was in the middle of the desert, but because of, you know, like low regulation, lower taxes, it encourages businesses to open up casinos. And therefore, you know, there was more business activity. So I was just curious, like, what are your thoughts on that argument?
I see. So let me see if I want to make sure I understand the argument. It sounds like you're saying your uncle generally believes that demand is what drives businesses to open. There's demand for a product or service, so that's an opportunity for a business to enter. But with Vegas, his argument is, in Vegas, what created all of these casinos and hotels and all of this stuff is that there was low regulation, so it was attractive rather than demand driven. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yes, correct.
Okay. I think the counterpoint would be, and I think it's a natural one in a sense, there was already pent up demand for what Vegas initially offered. It was demand from all over the United States. There was already, even if people did not necessarily know, what we're looking for is a gaming paradise in the desert or whatever. You had a population that was big enough with diverse enough interests that there was a pent up demand. And so that's why business people, when they said, hey, what about a casino? Vegas is a good place. The low regulation may have been why they chose Vegas. But the demand generally for a gaming industry was already there.
I see. Okay. So So do you think it depends on particular services or products that supply or demand is going to be the determining factor? Do you think, you know, there are some cases that supply may drive businesses?
Yeah. So listen, here's the thing. This is a quite an involved topic. There are products and services that benefit, for example, from network effects, where actually more supply increases the perceived value of the product or service, and supply can actually drive demand. There are luxury goods where you actually might sometimes see supply and demand interact in different ways than a typical supply and demand curve. There's really no one answer to this, and one can generally speaking understand that demand drives hiring while still realizing that there are other types of situations that we have to sort of account for separately.
Right, I see. Wow, that was great. The idea of pent up demand. Yeah, I didn't think of that. Awesome. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Yeah, and last thing.
Yeah.
The low regulation alone, if there was no pent up demand for hotels and casinos, you can go whether there's low or high regulation and build a hotel and casino. If nobody wants to be in a casino, it's not going to matter that the regulation was low. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. I do. Exactly.
All right, Wynn, thank you. I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
All right. Win from Thailand, now in Indiana. Let's take a quick break. Don't hang up if you're holding, because we're going to get right back to a few more calls right after this short break. All right. Let's speak to a few more people via the David Pakman Show Discord, which you can find at davidpakman.com/Discord. It is a great Discord. I highly, highly recommend it. Let's go next to Will from L.A. Now, is that Los Angeles or Louisiana?
It's Los Angeles.
All right. Welcome.
How you doing? Sorry if this has already been brought up before, but curious about your thoughts on this Gabby Petito thing. Obviously, it's a huge story. But then on one side, you hear a lot of people kind of irritated that a lot of Black and Indigenous and Hispanic people aren't getting the same, sort of visibility for their case. I'm just curious what your thoughts on that are. I mean, I personally think it's really tough to demean this poor girl's existence, to demean her own individual case by, you know, complaining about maybe other cases that don't get the same sort of coverage. And I'm just curious what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah. So there's really three stories here. And we talked about this on a bonus show earlier this week. So first, there's just the facts of the Gabby Petito story. As of this moment, her fiance, Brian Laundrie, is missing. There's speculation as to, you know, his involvement in her disappearance and subsequent death, et cetera, et cetera. So there's the facts of that story and the way that it's been reported. These stories, they do really well, particularly for local news stations. Like, I think there's a station in Tampa that has just done really well covering every aspect of this. And so it's sort of like a car chase. Fox News starts covering the car chase, et cetera. So there's that and the salacious nature of the initial story. Then you started to see commentaries from like Joy Reid on MSNBC and some other places saying, hey, you know what? This is missing white girl syndrome. If this was a Black woman, if this was an Indigenous woman or whatever, you would not be seeing this amount of coverage. Newsweek even had an article where they said, hey, you know what? Gabby Petito went missing in Wyoming. Over the last decade, 466 Indigenous women have gone missing in Wyoming. None of them got this amount of coverage. I think to some degree that's true. I also think it's a combination of factors. It's pretty 22-year-old white girl, some social media notoriety, a 90-minute or hour-long police stop body cam video that adds to the mystique and it adds to the story. The fiance goes missing. You know, I think that there are more aspects to it, but I think to some degree there is a difference in coverage based on the identity of the victim. And then the third story is many of the media outlets criticizing the coverage, saying when it's a Black woman or an Indigenous woman, we don't get the coverage. They also never covered the missing Black or Indigenous women, which is like the third layer, which is they are making headlines talking about the disparity, but they contributed to that very same disparity. You know what I'm saying, Will?
I totally agree with that point. Absolutely. Yeah.
So in terms of not demeaning this, what happened to Gabby Petito, I'm with you. Like, her case is no less tragic because of these other meta stories. It's sort of like running through a cancer fundraiser and saying, what about AIDS? Right. Like, I get that. It's still important to understand why certain stories get more coverage than others, though.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really is important to understand. And I feel for anybody that goes missing. It doesn't matter their you know, gender or race or anything.
Of course.
It's terrible. And I just I hope that there's more light that is shined on those people, mm-hmm. You know, on anybody that goes missing. And I also, you know, hope for some sort of healing for, you know, Gabby's family and people who loved her. And it's terrible all around anybody who goes missing. But thank you so much for your time, David. I really appreciate you. Big fan of the show.
Thanks, Will. Will from L.A. Very much appreciate the call and a good topic. I mean, there's a lot of different stories there. That's the reality. Let's go next to Itai from one of my favorite cities in the world, Copenhagen, Denmark. Itai, you are on the air.
Hi, David. It's good to speak to you.
Pleasure.
All right. So I have a hypothesis about why American politics is the way it is.
Okay.
And basically it's this. The American electoral system allows us to have basically the worst, allows both parties to be basically unaccountable and still win, because if you look at it, technically speaking, the rules are that you only have to perform better than everyone else, sort of individually. We call it a single winner system.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually guarantees that you have a two-party system like you have in America, where, you know, you have a party like the Republican Party that's just a cult now. And I think that that is really the main problem with American politics.
So let me see if I understand. So basically what you're saying is, no matter how bad Republicans are or get in terms of being radical, in terms of being a cult, in terms of mm-hmm. being unhinged, in any particular election where they can claim to be slightly less bad than Democrats, they have a shot at winning. And that's a real problem.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you.
In Denmark, we use something called proportional representation, where
yes.
the amount of vote you get is proportional to how much people support your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, just it's kind of miserable, that abysmal, that we live in you people in America have to live in a system where they're not able to have a different option, because the way the American system works is you only have to get a plurality. You don't have to get more than if you get a really huge number of votes, or if you have a lot of support, your idea won't get into government. Like if you look at the percentage of people in Congress that support or oppose something like Medicare for All, and then you compare a policy in Denmark, and you compare how the government, the people in government, the parliament support or oppose a policy compared to the population as a whole, there's a very strong correlation, but
right.
there isn't in America, because the system just allows the worst kind of people to win elections.
Yeah, this is just a feature of the first past the post plurality system that we have. Now, you know, in some cases, you actually do have to get a majority. So if no one gets 50%, there's a runoff. But OK, we can put that aside for now. You can have a district where 45% of the population wants Medicare for All, and 45% of the voters vote for the candidate that wants Medicare for All. That candidate loses. And the representation of that district, which is 45% for Medicare for All, is only one elected official who does not support Medicare for All. That's just a fundamental problem with the system that we have. There's no way around it. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. But if we use the Danish system,
of course,
then I think the Republicans would never win another election, or maybe they would still have supporters, but they would never be in office again.
Well, hold on a second, because with a system like that, you could also have Republicans from some of the minority Republican districts that are only represented by a Democrat right now. I mean, there's two sides to that.
Well, I guess, but at least we wouldn't. One product of the proportional system is that you actually have like a multi-party system. So
yes.
we'd at least know where people stand, because I know that there are people who vote Republican who are actually have populist opinions and would probably vote for a different party if they had a better system to go to.
There would be Democrats also who might vote, Green Party or something else as well. But I think it's a very, very interesting proposal. Listen, we keep reading about how great things are in Denmark, 75%+ vaccination. Is anybody wearing masks anywhere at this point?
Not at all.
No masks. And things are okay.
Things are great.
Wow. Wow. I really miss it. It's really, Copenhagen is such a great city. The biking, the bike lanes, the food is fantastic. It's just so great, you know?
Yeah, I love it.
Well, I hope to get back there soon. I appreciate the call.
Thank you, David. Have a nice day.
There is Itai from Copenhagen, Denmark. What a special city. What a special city, my friends. Let's go next. Let's go elsewhere. Okay. Let's go to Richard from California. Richard, you're on the air. Richard, please go right into your question, my friend.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, David. I've been a longtime listener, first time caller. I especially really like your coverage during the Capitol riot. It really turned my dad from a conservative to a moderate.
Wow, that's good.
All right, so I've been living in Los Angeles for a long, long time.
Okay.
And lately, I've just been noticing that there's been like a lack of empathy for the homeless population. And my main concern is that because there are some groups who are trying to help the homeless, but the problem is that there's like a large like pushback. Like even our own sheriff, even like when there was a plan to do like affordable housing or free housing for them, our sheriff said that, oh no, it's gonna entice people from other states to come to our state, but he never offered like a solution to it.
Right.
Yeah, so my main concern, like eventually, like my question is that do you think eventually like our representatives or people will start like calling like on for the homeless to be sent to like Death Valley or to be like, I don't want to be,
I mean,
like,
listen, or there's already people calling for that sort of thing. I mean, it almost starts to get concentration campy, you know. Here's the thing, we've had enough pilot programs at this point to know how to deal with a problem of homelessness, which is first you've got to provide the resources and allow people to learn and make sure you help people learn that they exist. And it's cheaper to house, feed, and provide health care to homeless people than to criminalize homelessness or to try to push homeless people around to different places. It just makes more economic sense. Once you do that, I'm open to the idea that, hey, these resources are now available, if they are. Now we can start an information campaign about, at a certain point, the encampments are not going to be allowed anymore. Why? Well, because we have the resources, and having the resources is key. But just shipping people off to Death Valley, I mean, it's inhumane. It's crazy that you know, I hope that doesn't happen.
All right. Yeah, it's just been like, I've been like, ever since I was young, I just remember like the homeless crisis it was like small, but now it's getting worse and worse. And
especially I understand with that.
Yeah, with the moratoriums ending, it's going to get real worse. You know, I remember a lot of my classmates in elementary, they lost their houses during the financial crisis in 08.
Yeah.
And it was terrible.
And wow.
Yeah. And a quick question. Like, because I've been a long time listener, I was wondering, like, have you kept in touch with Lewis, or do you think he can make a guest appearance on a future show?
Oh, yeah. I see Lewis every couple weeks, and he's welcome anytime. Maybe he'll join me on a live stream soon or something like that.
Ooh, all right. Well, thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure. But what part of LA are you in generally?
Like in South Central, like Southgate, California.
Got it. Okay. All right. Very good. Right. I appreciate the call.
All right. Thank you, David.
All right. Thanks, everybody who called in today. I will not be taking more calls right now, but we will take calls again. All right. Let's get into your emails, the email bag, so to speak. It's really more of a folder, but, you know, I think the imagery of the mail bag is still maybe relevant in modern society in 2021. info@davidpakman.com is the place to email. Let's see what's on some people's minds. First, many responses to my response to Nicki Minaj's tweet about her cousin's friend's testicle swelling. You guys remember this story? Phil wrote to me and said, technical response to swollen apple bags. Hey, David, just watched your episode and thought you might want to read through this. Yes, of course it can occur with STIs, but it can also occur via COVID itself, apparently, or mumps. I'm vaccinated and had a breakthrough case along with my girlfriend a couple weeks ago and was panicking when I noticed a bit of inflammation on myself. After extensive Googling, because I currently don't have health insurance through my employer, I live in Texas, big surprise, right? I came across a few articles like this. Just wanted to send it your way since it seems more likely to me that Nicki Minaj's cousin's brother's dog sitter twice removed probably just got exposed to COVID after getting the vaccine than getting it from the vaccine or an STI, even although that's obviously statistically more likely than getting it from the vaccine. Yeah, it's the Ministry of Health from Trinidad and Tobago said we found no reporting at all about this case of the swollen testicles from the vaccine. And I think if it is even at all real, which we don't know, but if it's a real story, if Nicki Minaj's cousin's friend's testicles really did swell, it would almost certainly be from something else. Could be COVID itself, could be orchitis from gonorrhea, chlamydia, you know, something else. Also an email about Tucker Carlson's interest in the swollen testicles of Nicki Minaj's cousin's friend. JFK wrote in and said, Tucker Carlson's rant over someone else's balls has a different problem. How many men have experienced erection issues under stress? Every man has at some point. The guy's fiance calls off the wedding because he's dysfunctional. Better that he found out now she didn't really love him. Let's take this to the bizarre far-right Bible-thumping side. Why is she having sex before marriage? There is far more evidence that SARS-CoV-2 can and does cause capillary dysfunction in male testicles. Yeah, that's another story that was brought to light accurately, which is COVID itself seems to carry a risk of sexual dysfunction. But I keep going back that it is weird that because of a vaccine, a supposed vaccine reaction, Nicki Minaj's cousin's friend's fiance called off the wedding. It's like, well, if it's just a medical issue reacting to the vaccine, wouldn't you just get married anyway? Or it's all very, very strange. Next email is from Brendan. Brendan writes in about the Novavax vaccine, says, hey, David, I believe we'll see vaccination rates go up in this country about 20% if the Novavax vaccine ends up becoming available in the U.S. Many COVID vaccine hesitant people who are currently unvaccinated are holding out for the Novavax as its subunit protein technology makes it closer to traditional influenza vaccines. It also has greater than 90% efficacy from trials and has been touted as likely the best vaccine yet, even by publications like The Atlantic. Have you read up on it? I have, but not recently enough to know whether these claims are still accurate. Brendan says, anyway, I think the vax issue, this is a vax issue worth discussing. I am open to and interested in any efficacious and safe vaccine being put forward with the goal of it working for someone who's not yet been vaccinated. I hesitate to put too much stock in any people still not vaccinated claiming I'll get vaccinated as soon as X, because for the most part, there's been a lot of BS. Look at all the people who said I'd get vaccinated as soon as the vaccine is FDA approved. The numbers have barely trickled up since the Pfizer vaccine was FDA approved weeks ago. Many of them have moved on to something else, including saying the approval is untrustworthy because it was political or whatever the case may be. So I am really skeptical about any one thing having that much of an impact, except the airfare, the air aviation thing. I do think that while it won't be the 41% of anti-vax people who claimed they would get vaccinated if you need one to fly, I don't think 41% will actually go and do it. I do have every belief that if a vaccine was required to fly, a lot of anti-vax people would go and get vaccinated. So Novavax, airline requirement, you know, employee requirement. Let's try everything to try to get those numbers up. Next email is from Randall. Randall wrote in about the January 5th, January 6th pipe bomb surveillance video. These are the pipe bombs placed in D.C. on January 5th, found on January 6th in and around the time that the Trump riots were going on. Randall says, David, I believe that you and your friends are correct about the suspect being a woman. As you watch the suspect, as they sit down on the bench, they place their knees together. How many men do that? Definitely a woman. I actually didn't notice that, and I don't know much about that. I've never really paid attention to placing knees together. When I sit down, yeah, I guess I don't put my knees together, but that's just me. I don't know if this is some kind of gender stereotype, if there's any basis in science. I really have no idea. I've also not heard anything additional about the identity of the pipe bomb suspect. And it is so difficult for me to believe that nobody knows a thing about it. It's just really, really difficult to imagine that that's the case. Hopefully we will know something soon. And yeah, I got a lot of emails after the segment last week from people saying, I agree with you, David. I do think that the suspect is a woman. That may have been because I mentioned it. I really don't know. I have no idea. But if you know anything, please, please, please contact the FBI. Very, very important stuff. Next email is from Paul. Paul writes to me the only legitimate anti-vax argument. So I thought this should be good. Let's see what Paul says. Dear David, while most of the arguments I've heard from the anti-vaxxers are based on conspiracy theories or simply scientifically inaccurate, there is one legitimate reason for vaccine hesitancy that I can't argue against. We don't know the long-term effects of these vaccines. We don't know that 5 to 10 years from now, vaccinated individuals won't be dropping dead of heart attacks. What do you say to people who have these fears, and what makes you so confident you won't develop long-term side effects? Cheers, Paul. This is not a new argument, okay? This is an indefeasible argument, because you can always argue, however long a vaccine's been out, we don't yet know that some kind of side effect doesn't start right after that. The polio vaccine, it's been out 70 years. How do we know that on year 71, the polio vaccine doesn't cause some kind of problem? The problem with this argument is it's indefeasible. You can't defeat this argument, because you could always say, well, the vaccine's been out 11 years. The problems might start after 12 years. So my feeling on this is, based on speaking to doctors and virologists and epidemiologists about how the vaccine works and how the substance of the vaccine clears from your body relatively quickly, I have no reason to believe that there is some magical period of time after which there will be some new problem. In addition to that, with the very narrow exception about GBS, Guillain-Barré syndrome, which we've talked about and which is now better understood, there aren't examples of what this person is saying either. So it's not about why am I personally so confident I won't have a long-term side effect in 5 years, in 10 years, whatever, from the vaccine. The decades-long research on mRNA technology, and now the century of vaccination, century plus, actually, if you include, you know, smallpox, tells us that that does not seem to be how vaccine works. And so that's why I've made the decision to go and get vaccinated. But this is the type of argument that you can never defeat, because they could always say, listen, if OK, the vaccine causes no side effects for 100 years, if lifespans increase, we don't know what that vaccine could do. You can always make that argument. It really gets us nowhere. It's not supported by evidence. OK, and then Kurt wrote to me. Kurt wrote to me about rules during the pandemic. Kurt says, an old newspaper article from 1918 showing a list of do's and don'ts for preventing the Spanish flu looks painfully familiar. My favorite is this one. Quote, do not disregard the advice of a specialist just because you do not understand. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of depressing in a sense that we have all these new medical technologies, mRNA vaccine, we're developing, we have all these new treatments, and we have, you know, ECMO machines and ventilators and all these different things. But to just stop the spread It's hygiene, it's physical distance, and it's masking. That's basically what it is. This really hasn't changed. And yet still, we have so many people who either don't understand it or refuse to do it or think they know better than the experts or believe the experts are part of some conspiracy. There's a lot of stuff. And we interviewed an author who's a historian of the 1918 flu. And he told us about a lot of the same dynamics, science, skeptical people, people refusing to participate in the guidelines, et cetera, 100 years ago. I mean, 103 years ago at this point in time. Some things never change, seemingly, or at least they take a really long time to change. Send me your emails. Maybe they will be picked and featured on next week's email bag. info@davidpakman.com. We've got a great bonus show coming up for you today. You can sign up at joinpakman.com. Please sign up. It really is a great revenue source for us. It makes us independent of big media and advertisers because it's just you guys. You guys control the show. You fund the show. You can sign up at joinpakman.com and use the coupon code BETTER21. We'll see you on the bonus show if you're not so inclined. But
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
Hi, we're the Deliverance Strangers, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me. For all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
WRCT is on AOL Instant Messenger. Our screen name is WRCT883. Send us a shout-out so we can make fun of your atrocious spelling. Send us a request. Send us anything. We're bored. WRCT, 88.3 FM on your radio, WRCT.org on the internet, and now WRCT883 on AOL Instant Messenger. In the language of the kids today, we're the bomb. That's right, isn't it? That's what the kids say. We're the bomb, correct?
Or I'm from creationist crucifixion.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3, arr.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
And your soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, home of... Oh, crap. We're not really home of anything, are we?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh, yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Hello, I'm Meg Lee Chin, and when I'm in town, I like to listen to WRCT 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you in the morning.
We at WRCT Pittsburgh do not condone the illegal duplication of copyrighted material. But if you happen to own all the tracks we played and would like a copy of them, just FTP to FTP.
Due to a request by Computing Services, the remainder of this announcement cannot...
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Hi, this is Dean from Luna. You're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT in Pittsburgh.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without...
Alicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
First of all, we were taken as held for ransom. Then I was sold to the CIA as Al-Qaeda general, middle-aged Egyptian, you know, a 9/11 insider. I was taken to the black site, where I was like tortured for over 2 months. Then from the black site to Kandahar detention.
Today we spend the hour with Mansour Adaifi. He was imprisoned at Guantanamo for over 14 years after being sold as a teenager to the CIA by an Afghan warlord after the 9/11 attacks. By the time he was released, he'd spent half his life in U.S. custody, but was never charged with a crime. He'll talk about being tortured and why he repeatedly went on hunger strike to protest inhumane conditions.
We were hurting ourselves. I always tell the people, you know, our bodies was the battlefield, because Americans torture us, abuse us, and beat us. And in our bodies, also we were torturing our bodies by hunger strike, by try to resist. And I wrote about it, the hunger strike. It was a slow journey to death, toward death. That's hunger strike.
Mansour Adaifi will also talk about his new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo, and how art helped him and others survive the prison.
Art connect us to the world outside. You can see the brothers we paint, see trees, the things we missed most: sky, the stars, you know, homes, deserts, and so on.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Del Rio, Texas, a makeshift encampment where up to 30,000 Haitian asylum seekers stayed or passed through was cleared by authorities as the Biden administration continues to expedite its mass expulsion of migrants without due process. At least five deportation flights took off Sunday, with thousands expelled in the past week alone. The International Organization for Migration says dozens of children with non-Haitian passports were among those deported. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said about 12,000 people were allowed to remain in the U.S. to fight for asylum. Meanwhile, an estimated 8,000 Haitians were forced to cross the border back into Mexico after facing violence and being deprived of food, water, and shelter. In Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, demonstrators condemned the inhumane treatment of asylum seekers in the United States.
We're here not to ask for favors from the United States. We're here demanding that they respect that we, as Haitians, as Haitian migrants, have rights. We are demanding that American laws on immigration be applied to Haitians, just as they are applied to those from other countries.
Meanwhile, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry told world leaders at the UN General Assembly that migration will continue as long as massive global inequalities exist. In Germany, the center-left Social Democratic Party has narrowly claimed victory in an election that puts an end to the 16-year era of Angela Merkel's leadership. Merkel's party